genocide in Gaza and his plan to forcibly displace Palestinians amounts to ethnic cleansing. Hello everyone and welcome to World News. Now the UN Security Council has finally passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2024/254 please raise their hand? The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 27-28-2024.
A draft resolution was jointly submitted by the current 10 non-permanent members of the Council of 14 countries, including 4 permanent members of the UN body, voted in favor of the resolution, except for the U.S., that chose to abstain from the voting. The actual draft demanded an immediate ceasefire in the holy month of Ramadan, leading to a permanent, sustainable ceasefire. But the Russian representative, in a statement before the vote, said that the word permanent was omitted before the meeting. Over the past 5 months since Israel launched its genocidal war, Washington has vetoed 3 draft resolutions on a Gaza ceasefire, sparking condemnations at home and abroad. Meanwhile, Hamas has welcomed adoption of the UN Security Council resolution for the immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It stressed the need for a permanent ceasefire that will lead to the withdrawal of all Israeli forces from the territory and return of displaced Gazans to their homes. The resistance movement also expressed readiness for a deal securing the release of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails in exchange for Israeli captives held in Gaza. It also called for delivery of all humanitarian supplies needed in the besieged strip. Hamas further urged UN Security Council to pressure the Israeli regime into observing the ceasefire and to stop its genocide of Palestinians. Palestinian ambassador to the UN Riyad Mansour has hailed the Security Council resolution on a Gaza ceasefire, expressing hope move will put an end to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
This must be a turning point. This must lead to saving lives on the ground. This must signal the end of this assault of atrocities against our people. A nation is being murdered. A nation is being dispossessed. A nation is being displaced for decades now, but never at this scale since the Nakba. Never this openly, from Tantura to Gaza, from 1948 to 2024. Mr. President, now that this council has finally called for a ceasefire, all forces should coalesce to make sure it is enforced. Apologies to those who the world has failed, to those that could have been saved and were not. Save the lives of those who survived against all odds. Tell them help is on the way. Hold accountable those who inflicted such suffering upon them. End this injustice. End it now. All of this is long overdue. And I thank you very much, Mr. President.
A U.S. abstention on the U.N. Security Council's Gaza ceasefire resolution has angered Israel. The regime says it will not send a delegation now to Washington, D.C. to discuss the Rafah invasion. The Israeli Prime Minister's office said that U.S. abstention hurt regime's war effort and efforts made to release Israeli captives in Gaza. It added, the decision is a clear retreat from Washington's consistent position. The U.S. says it's very disappointed by cancellation of the Israeli delegation's visit. A U.N. Security Council resolution has been welcomed by many countries and international bodies, including South Africa, the Arab League, the European Union, and West Asian states. Israel, however, has said it will not end its war on Gaza despite this resolution until all Israeli captives in Gaza are released. Meanwhile, Iran's welcome adoption of the resolution by the UN Security Council as a positive, though inadequate, step. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said, "What is more important than passing a resolution is taking effective measures to enforce it and end Israel's attacks on Gaza and the occupied West Bank." He added, "Lifting Israel's siege of Gaza, sending extensive humanitarian aid in, and international funding for Gaza reconstruction are other important steps that have to be taken." Kanani said Israel's reaction to the resolution shows how angry it is about irreparable defeat the regime has suffered in the political and international arenas. He said the Security Council must hold Israel accountable for crimes it's committed against the Palestinians during the past 6 months. And earlier, for the latest Israeli atrocities against the people of Gaza, we're joined by our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, from the central city of Deir al-Balah.
According to Gaza's health ministry, that the Israeli occupation forces over the last 24 hours committed at least 11 appalling massacres against the Palestinian civilians across all areas of Gaza Strip, claiming the lives of at least 107 Palestinian civilians and injuring roughly 176 others. These numbers are rising incrementally with the continuous and ongoing Israeli attacks and airstrikes and incursions that are still covering all areas of Gaza Strip. Here in Deir al-Balah city and in the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes attacked Al-Mughraga neighborhood, claiming the lives of six Palestinian civilians. More civilian cars are bringing more Palestinian casualties left behind that airstrike. The ambulances are dispatched these moments. Apparently, there is multiple casualties left behind that airstrike. It was a huge airstrike. Yes, evidently, it is another massacre took place moments ago in Deir al-Balah city, particularly the surrounding areas, the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. So the current situation is catastrophic and chaotic. Here is another civilian car bringing more Palestinian casualties. So this is the current situation so far. This is what is happening these moments in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital.
Now, 6 months into Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, regime forces continue pounding homes, refugee camps, and aid convoys, resulting in the deaths of more Palestinian civilians.
We came running and found the houses, as you see, destroyed and flattened, and we began the process of bringing out the wounded, survivors, and martyrs. Unfortunately, there is no safe place in the Gaza Strip. There are houses of displaced people and civilians who have nothing to do with anything. The ruthless enemy has left no safe place in Gaza.
At least 107 civilians lost their lives in Israeli bombing and shelling over the past day. 32 were killed in Israeli airstrikes on residential buildings in the southern city of Rafah. And a home was bombed in the central city of Deir al-Balah, leaving at least 18 people dead there. According to media reports, Israeli attacks also in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City left a number of casualties. Areas surrounding Amal Hospital and Khan Yunis were shelled as well. Regime forces have laid siege to several hospitals in Gaza, preventing medical supplies from reaching them. Israeli onslaught, which began back on October the 7th, has so far claimed more than 32,300 lives and left over 75,000 others injured. A UN rights expert says there are reasonable grounds to determine that Israel has committed acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing in its Gaza onslaught. Francesca Albanese, a UN special rapporteur on occupied Palestinian territory, said in her report, Israel has violated three of the five acts listed under the International Genocide Convention. The expert added, the overwhelming scale of Israel's attacks on Gaza reveals the regime's intent is to physically destroy Palestinians as a group. Albanese also asserted statements by senior Israeli officials about the forcible displacement of Palestinians and replacing them with settlers amount to ethnic cleansing. Albanese's report is due to be presented to the UN Human Rights Council this Tuesday. Leader of Ansar, the movement has praised the Yemeni nation's resilience and unity in the face of Saudi-led coalition's aggression. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the people of Yemen have overcome invading forces and continue making progress. Houthi was speaking in a televised address marking the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen. He denounced the Saudi-led aggression as an unjustified and treacherous war whose goal was to destroy Yemen, occupy it, and undermine the rights of its people to freedom and independence. Houthi said aggression resulted in deaths and injuries of over 50,000 civilians. The Ansarullah leader also said the Saudi-led aggression was all part of a larger geopolitical strategy pushed by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel to reshape the region for the benefit of the Zionist entity. He affirmed, despite extensive damage to Yemen's infrastructure and the high civilian death toll, the nation's spirit remains unbroken. Houthi pledged Yemen will further develop its indigenous military capabilities and its economy and called on certain countries to reassess their miscalculations and aggressive policies towards Sana'a. The Yemeni Scholars Association organized an event to encourage Muslim scholars worldwide to unite and advocate for the Palestinian people amidst the ongoing war in Gaza. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has your story from Sana'a.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa Flood battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemy's crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies.
Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. occupation forces carried out a series of airstrikes against targets in eastern Syria near the border with Iraq. Reports say that American warplanes carried out 10 simultaneous strikes on residential neighborhoods and military installations in Deir ez-Zor province, including cities of Deir ez-Zor, Al-Mayadeen, and Al-Bukamal. They say at least 20 people, including women and children, were injured. No more details have so far been provided, but U.S. regularly conducts airstrikes in Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Damascus has written numerous letters to the U.N., calling on the world body to put an end to U.S. attacks and its military presence in the Arab country. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the Kremlin knows who carried out recent terrorist attack in Moscow, but wants to find out who ordered it.
We also see that the United States, through various channels, is trying to convince its satellite countries and other countries of the world that, according to their intelligence, there is allegedly no trace of Kiev in the terrorist attack in Moscow, that the bloody terrorist attack was committed by members of Daesh. We know by whose hand this atrocity against Russia and its people was committed, but we want to know who ordered them to do it.
Putin stressed assailants tried to flee to Ukraine, adding, there are many questions to be examined. He said attack may just be a link in a whole series of attempts by those who have been at war with Russia since 2014 through a neo-Nazi regime in Kiev. Putin reiterated that the attack was meant to sow panic among Russians. Four gunmen burst into Moscow's Krokus City Hall on Friday and began shooting at people who were attending a concert. They killed nearly 140 people and injured over 180 others. 11 people, including attackers, have been detained and are facing terrorism charges. Ukraine has denied any role in this attack. That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. Happy Iranian New Year!
Alongside Iranians in Nowruz. In the name of God, Salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the sixth day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. Today, we will speak about the customs of Nowruz of the people living in Khorasan. Khorasan is the name of a region straddling through the vast area of northeastern Iran. It used to be a single province called Khorasan, but a few decades ago, it was divided into three provinces, namely North Khorasan, Khorasan Razavi, and South Khorasan. However, the people of all three provinces maintain similar customs and traditions, especially those of Khorasan Razavi and South Khorasan. Stay tuned, please. Khorasan literally means the land of sun and the place where the sun rises from. The land of Greater Khorasan once included areas in Iran, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and even beyond. Thus, there are traces of all these languages and dialects in today's Khorasan in Iran. Some of these languages and dialects are vernacular, while others are spoken by migrants who have emigrated from other regions in the past centuries and decades. As you know, one of the most important symbols of Nowruz in Iran is Haft Sin tablecloth. This tablecloth is composed of different items and edibles, which make it colorful and beautiful. However, the edibles of this tablecloth are prepared in different regions according to the taste of the women of those regions. One of the famous items in Haftsin tablecloth is samanu. As you have already heard, samanu is a kind of pudding made from fresh wheat sprouts. Women in Khorasan put pots in the yard or on the roof 40 to 50 days before Nowruz to be filled with rainwater. Then they pour some wheat in a white and fine cloth and put it in the rainwater to shoot. The wheat shoots and the fresh sprouts are then smashed and mixed with common flour. A few days before Nowruz, the mixture is blended with things like date syrup, rose water, and almond. After that, big copper pots are put on fire to cook samanu. It takes long hours to cook, during which several people keep stirring the pots so that samanu is cooked slowly and not burned. In the end, women take a part of samanu for Haftsin tablecloth and distribute the rest among the neighbors and relatives. People of Khorasan, like people in other regions of Iran, have nice traditions. One of these traditions is called Shah Molai, which is held a few days before the arrival of Nowruz. The trustworthy people in every neighborhood go to those who are wealthy and generous, asking them for catering to the needs of the poor and needy. Another custom among the people of Khorasan in Nowruz is called Hanabandan. People of the region, especially women, dye their hair and hands with henna to welcome Nowruz. They believe that henna causes high spirit and exuberance. However, the most outstanding custom in Khorasan is to visit the holy mausoleum of Imam Reza, peace upon him, the 18th Falibel, heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in the city of Mashhad. As a matter of fact, anyone who can try to reach the holy city of Mashhad for pilgrimage of Imam Reza, in a bid to start the year with blessing. The people of Mashhad have another custom after pilgrimage of Imam Reza. They buy some fresh vegetables and bread and then return home believing that this will bless the house and the family. Another interesting custom in Khorasan is to prepare a special kind of ash or broth called jushware. To prepare this food, women spread wheat dough and form it into sheets. Then they fill the sheets with chopped onion, cooked lentils, and peas and spices. Some others add meat and walnut too. Then the sheets are folded as triangles and pressed so that they do not open. At this phase, the triangles are put in boiling water to cook. After the broth boils, some whey powder is added. This food is eaten on the first day of Nowruz in family gatherings. Another custom that is common in villages is to bake a lot of bread a few days before the arrival of Nowruz. They believe that every house should be full of bread so that blessing is bestowed upon them in the coming year. The housewives believe that during Nowruz they should not buy bread from outside. People of Khorasan, like all other Iranians, pay visits to the elderly on the first day of Nowruz. the elderly and the youths pray for each other and congratulate Nowruz. Then they eat sweets, pastries, fruits, and other edibles on half-seen tablecloth. In some parts of Khorasan, it is still customary that grandparents and parents take a plate with sweets, roasted wheat, roasted chickpeas, raisin, painted egg, and coin, and give them to young ones and children. Among the customs of Khorasan province, mention can be made of Bibi Gardi, which is common mostly in Qainat region of South Khorasan. It is held according to an old story. On the 12th of Farvardin, the first month of the Iranian calendar year, old women, who are called Bibi, are taken outside the village. A Bibi takes some clay and covers it with mud. Women and girls make a candle with a stick and cotton as its wick. Then they burn it on the clay. Bibi holds the candle on her head and women and girls leave the village behind her while rejoicing. Then they gather around the qanat or well and throw the clay in the well, believing that their sorrows would end with it to start a happy year. Dear listeners, next time we will go to south of Iran for Nowruz customs.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome. Now, the only effective and efficient way to deliver heavy goods to meet Gaza's humanitarian needs is by road, and that includes an exponential increase in commercial deliveries. Now, these are not my words, but the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who made the comments during his visit to Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisum Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims and forcing the men to watch it. That's, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with a lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered basically a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, the enemy of the people of Esther. So every year this holiday is celebrated, and it's not just extending to Persians, but anybody who they view as their enemy. This is like celebration of revenge. It's very, very, very sick stuff, and it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen to happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, to relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself, the very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization, just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well. The Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, a fertility goddess. if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance, because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest, and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims and the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel, because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm actually very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the axis of resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
But that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon, and even now we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that. Again, few days cleans up. Now, this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guest in Los Angeles spoke about, this optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. This is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Salam, that is absolutely right, and I believe our guest from Los Angeles also agrees, and I agree as well, that the Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned, and now their true colors have been known to the entire world. So they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in. And the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much, unfortunately, compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where we also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now, but again, very difficult.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for a humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. We see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber really meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. And they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened, because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed a second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran and to a lesser extent, Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansar Allah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically Russia and China will have no problem with Ansar Allah. And Ansar Allah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansar Allah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran in order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate the spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate the spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy, and then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism, and thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansar Allah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate tension, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Last week, Iran, Russia, and China kicked off their annual naval drills in the northern Indian Sea, specifically the Gulf of Oman, to ensure maritime security and combat piracy. The theme of the joint operation being creating peace and security together. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV noted, as the spillover into the Indian Ocean begins, security for the region is at an all-time high demand. Iran will not tolerate U.S. warships being deployed near its territorial waters to protect Zionist commerce. Thus, these drills serve as an essential practice for Iran to test its new weaponry and be prepared should the U.S. think it can arrogantly impose itself on Iranian waters on behalf of the Tel Aviv regime. Concerning this situation and the drills from last week, immediate developments can be observed, especially for Iran. Shortly after the drills concluded, the U.S. intelligence community's 2024 threat assessment report was released, which stated the following about the Islamic Republic's capabilities. Iran's missile, UAV, air defense, and naval capabilities will continue to threaten U.S. and partner commercial and military assets in the Middle East, and Iran will remain a threat to Israel and U.S. allies and interest in the region well after the Gaza conflict. This is a direct deference to Iran's participation in the naval drill, its strong presence in safeguarding its territorial waters, and its dedication to the Palestinian cause, rejecting any foreign presence within its waters, especially if it is in collaboration with the Zionist regime. Of course, these are all defensive practices, despite the U.S. claims to them being offensive. In another interview regarding the joint drill, Commander Irani said the presence of U.S. and U.S.-aligned countries is unjustified because their presence has never created security, adding that experience has shown that they have brought the greatest insecurity to the region. It is clear the emerging naval coalition is intent on actually delivering international maritime security, unlike U.S.-led countries that only serve their own interest at the expense of international security. Iran, Russia, and China are all part of the BRICS Economic Alliance as well as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with Iran being among the latest members of both alliances. The BRICS Alliance intends to represent the global majority in regard to their economic future. Any financial plan that does not guarantee security is doomed from the start, and so the drills will only become more sophisticated as official joint security operations are solidified. Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Oman, Pakistan, and South Africa were also invited as observers of the drill, countries that are either in the BRICS and/or SCO alliance or have regional relevance and security interest in regards to trade routes. Clearly, the naval alliance is demonstrating to all interested parties that the unipolar security guarantees are obsolete compared to what they have to offer. Mutual cooperation and respect for sovereignty while guaranteeing complete security responses. The naval drills will only become more sophisticated and more common as the security demands increase and economic alliances deepen. For example, with Iran's acquisition of the Russian Su-35 and an evolving lineup of jets from China's People's Liberation Army, aerial elements will be added not only to sea drills, but land defense drills as well. The security belt forged by the Triple Alliance is sure to expand, much to the dismay of the American imperialist, which has failed to set up a competent naval coalition even in response to Yemen's defensive operation, with Operation Prosperity Guardian falling apart before the first ship sailed. Countries will soon need to choose between sovereignty and multipolarity or submission and hegemony. The remaining question, what does the world expect as a response from a declining in power? One that cannot even muster up enough allies for a competent coalition. Russia, China, and Iran seem to have been intent on being prepared for the worst for benefit of global majority.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, make haste because it will all be over too soon. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. It's an honor to be here. We're talking about how we need to make haste because it will all be over too soon. So what are we talking about? Of course, we are talking about the holy month of Ramadan. We are in the holy month of Ramadan. And so, you know, make haste, because very surely and most surely this holy month of Ramadan is going to be over all too soon. And you know what? The holy month of Ramadan, with its beautiful breeze of forgiveness and joy and cheer and spiritual bliss, it truly does go by all too quickly. And it's quite unfortunate, because when we get to the end of the holy month of Ramadan and we move into the month of Shawwal, and after the first week or so of the month of Shawwal, we really miss the holy month of Ramadan. It is interesting, in many of the du'as that we find from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and specifically Imam Sajjad alayhi as-salam, the fourth divinely appointed Imam, you know, we find that the Imam talks about the holy month of Ramadan as if it were this very close and intimate and private friend of an individual. And, you know, it was a holy month that loved us and protected us and gave us value and honor. You know, it helped us to seek forgiveness